eventually the interest expenditures are going to constantly multiply and they'll crowd out everything else. We've reached a point where interest now is exceeding military expenditures. I mean, it's a three-year-old with a pocket calculator could figure this out. They don't disagree. They go, yeah, okay, fine, but that's 25 years from now. I might not be here. That's somebody else's problem. That's why I say these people that come up with these conspiracy theories, you're crediting these people with way too much intelligence. They have no strategy.
Martin Armstrong from Armstrong Economics. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Tom.
Well, Marty, you know, you and I were together recently at a conference here, and we've spoken before about your thoughts on, let's say, the leaders currently in the world and how many people credit them with being far smarter than they really are. Do you think that much of the current situation with Iran, even Ukraine right now, is due to this lack of strategic thinking?
Yes. I mean, I've been in this game for, you know, about 50 years. And what I've observed is I can go into government and say, if we don't do this, 25 million people will die tomorrow. And they'll say, yeah, well, maybe you're wrong. And from their perspective, if I said, vote for me because I saved your job, you're going to look at me and say, well, how do I know I would have lost it? Mm-hmm. It's better that you lose your job. And then I say, vote for me, I'll get the guy that did it. That's the way government functions. They like crisis. And when I was young and naive, I thought I could maybe make a difference. And you realize you can't. Mm-hmm. They're not interested in the long term. It's like, I just got to win the next election. You know, and when I've said, if we, you know, the national debt, I mean, common sense. I mean, I met with the Treasury back in 81 when interest rates were going up, you know, to 14%. And I said, guys, I said, national debt's going to double by the time, you know, the decade's finished. And very calmly, they said to me, yes, Marty, but we'll be paying back with cheaper dollars. And then I realized that nobody really gives a shit. About long term, that's it. I would say, gee, you know, look, eventually the interest expenditures are going to constantly multiply and they'll crowd out everything else. We've reached a point where interest now is exceeding military expenditures. I mean, it's a three-year-old with a pocket calculator could figure this out. Mm-hmm. All right. It's not, you know, a Nobel Prize winning science here that I'm talking about. It's, but you go in and you show them that. They don't disagree. What it is, they go, yeah, okay, fine, but that's 25 years from now. I might not be here. Mm-hmm. That's somebody else's problem. So that's why I say these people that come up with these conspiracy theories, you're crediting these people with way too much intelligence. They have no strategy. I mean, just look at the Iraq war. You can go online and look at Tony Blair's apology. And he says it right there. We had no idea taking Saddam Hussein out. We thought we were saving the people and we subjected them to more sectarian violence. He ended up with ISIS. So Saddam Hussein, yeah, you needed a dictator. He kept everybody from killing each other. I mean, once you removed him, then every religious group was a free for all. So, I mean, you know, they're ramifications to these things. And like with Iran, oh, we just got to remove the Ayatollah. Then what? I'll worry about that later. You know, there's no strategic long-term goals here. And that's the real problem. So you're looking at a real mess, and it gets me upset when these people come up with these conspiracy theories that they actually credit these people with intelligence they don't even know exists. And all they care about is winning the next election. What do I have to do for that? That's it. Talking about 30 years from now, 20 years? No. You know, their view is that's somebody else's problem. I'm not going to be here.
Well, we were kind of bouncing around this idea before we hit record this morning. And like, I always wonder if there's a way to incentivize better people to get into politics, or do you think that the system is just too far gone to actually attract anybody with strategic thinking, a backbone, or somebody that, you know, would actually do a reasonable job in trying to combat something like, let's say, the national debt or defense spending, something like that?
Unfortunately, what I've seen, the answer is no. I mean, look at what they did to just that Supreme Court justice. Woman coming forward, oh, he wanted to rape me. Oh, I think he wanted to. And then it turned out she didn't even go to that school. I mean, they just make up stuff. You know, I knew Steve Moore, who was the head of Cato Institute, and Trump had nominated him for the Federal Reserve. Immediately, they started attacking him, his wife, it would draw his name. Yeah. You know, it's what's happened, I think, in politics. If Trump says the sky is blue, they must say it's red. It's got nothing to do with the country anymore. Both sides must oppose whatever the other side says. Whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, they don't care anymore. So politics has become just a blood sport, really. Tear the other guy completely apart, destroy his career, his family, whatever, and then we go off to the next one. I don't know anybody who actually has experience and qualification that would be interested in this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, they're coming out with releasing the documents on the Clinton administration. I mean, the Clintons were one of the most dirtiest organizations around. You know, speaking fees from foreign governments. And I mean, I knew people that got pardons because their father gave $200,000 to Clinton. What I was in the middle of it was an attempted regime change of Russia back in 2000. I was flat out right told that. And it's, you know, that's why Hillary came up with the Russiagate stuff. Oh, well, Putin tried to interfere because she basically, they were doing that to Russia. You know, and you see this all the time. Like, we were giving weapons to Ukraine to, you know, to hurt Russia. And then they go, oh, it's not fair. Russia's giving stuff to Iran. Well, you know, we did it to them, so why wouldn't they do it back to us? I mean, it's, you just see this all the time. it makes you wonder, is there any intelligence left in Washington? I mean, I got calls, honestly, because I said that even when I was up there, you know, in Canada, I said, first of all, if I was going to go into Iran, the first thing I would have done was secure the Straits of Hormuz, all right, before the first bomb goes. And then I get calls saying, how did I know they were going to do that? I mean, my response is, how did you not know they were going to do that? I mean, that's been in the playbook for years. I mean, I don't know anybody who of any qualification who didn't know that they were going to use the Strait of Hormuz. Come on. And attacking the other Gulf states. Of course it made sense. All right. A tanker may have 3 million barrels. You take out the production. You bring the West to its knees. All right. And all the Gulf states are the ones that had the American bases.
Right.
I mean, it just gets to be the point, like, you have no strategy. You don't understand what you're even doing. You know, I think they, you know, when you look at Iraq and you look at Iran, they think, you know, you had Dick Cheney saying, oh, the Iran will just be a matter of weeks. It was 8 years. All right. They think that simply because you have the sophisticated and the biggest military, you automatically win. If they opened up a history book, you would see the biggest throughout history has always fallen. Persia fell to the Greeks. The Greeks fell to the Romans. All right. Carthage was the biggest. Rome, fledgling Rome, took them down. It's always that way. You just opened up a history book, you might see what really happens, you know. But that's all I can say is I think that they end up believing in their own bullshit, patting each other on the back. Yeah, you're right, or whatever. And we're the biggest, so we automatically win. Mm-hmm. Like I said, you can look up Dick Cheney. He said, oh, no, not months. This is just going to be weeks. 8 years.
So, Marty, do you think we're in a period of, you know, relative calm right now with respect to the Iran conflict, where the U.S. and Israel could be just, you know, rearming, getting more troops into the region, getting the aircraft carriers into the region, and there's another, you know, big wave of conflict coming here?
The computer definitely does not like from June on. But we're beginning to see that we have that problem. Not just in the Middle East, but also in Europe. You know, the EU has deliberately interfered and rigged elections. They did that. They started with the Scottish election when they wanted to, you know, separate from England. They did that in Italy. They rigged the elections there because they also, the leader at the time wanted to separate from the EU. They did the same thing in Romania, and they've done it again in Hungary. Mm-hmm. And Ursula, you know, when they formed the EU, the criticism was that they could be dictated to by an individual country like Germany again or something. So the structure was nothing could take place without a unanimous vote. So Hungary was preventing them from really starting World War III with Ukraine. So they had to get rid of Urban. And so as soon as they rigged the election, you got Ursula coming out saying they have to change the rules, that no single country can block them anymore. And Viktor was the only reasonable person in the EU. And he was preventing them from going to war with Russia. Now you have the head of the EU. He does whatever Ursula is going to tell him. He's out there, oh, a big war is coming. They want war because the EU is collapsing. So this is what you're looking at. And I fear that our computer is saying this is all going to start turning, back much more violent again from June. It's impacting both Europe with Ukraine as well as the Middle East. So as I've said before, our computer's been forecasting World War III, but it's not like World War I or II. It's just more conflicts everywhere. Rather than just one individual, we're against Germany and that's it, sort of thing. So this is what you're getting. You're seeing some resistance in Russia against Putin. Yeah, Putin and Jing, honestly, they're probably the two smartest guys sitting at the table, world leaders anymore. The rest of them, I wouldn't even sit down and have a drink with. It's just Starmer, Macron. I mean, come on. I think that the behind the scenes, the deep state is winning. They turned Trump around. They have infiltrated everything, completely Europe. NATO has just become a retirement home for neocons. And these people are there, and their object is to control the world. Simple as that. It's when Khrushchev said, "We will bury you," they all got their backs up. Well, we're going to bury you instead. And even though communism has failed, you have the Wolfowitz doctrine that came out in 91. And that said, we're going to suppress the rest of the world to make sure nobody else rises again to challenge the United States. Mm-hmm. And, it's total BS. Honestly, China is, when I was called into that briefing, they called me and they said they wanted to brief me on Russia. And they admitted, they said, "You're correct. We won't be at war with Russia. It will be China." So they more or less know at this stage of the game. Putin is not interested in invading Europe. That's all bullshit. That's the EU because they're falling apart economically. And I think the best measure of that, since every country uses different formulas for GDP and CPI and stuff, that's all rigged to make them look good. I think the one valid statistic is what percent of the total GDP is consumed by government. And In the U.S., it's about 35%. In Europe, it's 50. That's why their economic growth is so, it's nearly half that of the United States. They have no hope whatsoever of recovering or ever competing with the United States. They have to regulate absolutely everything. Part of the reason the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency is the United States has never canceled their currency. Even there in Canada, Trudeau canceled all the high denomination notes. In Europe, they cancel the currency routinely. Mm-hmm. So that if you had 100,000 euros stashed in a safety deposit box and they cancel the currency, forces you to bring them out, they go, oh, right. Where'd you get this? Did you pay your taxes? You know, I mean, India does that. I've got some of the high denomination Indian notes from the last time I was there in Mumbai, and they canceled those. So United States is the only country that has not canceled its currency. So that's why about 70% of the paper dollars are actually held outside the country. As I said, I went to Athens, and a guy knew I was an American, and he says, I'll give you 10% off if you pay me in dollars. You know, they wanted dollars rather than euro. Because he knows he can take that, stick it in the safety deposit box, it's okay. But he can't do that with a euro. And this is why you're seeing also capital fleeing to the United States. It's getting to be widely anticipated with the CBDC stuff in Europe, where they're moving as fast as they can, and they will cancel the currency to prevent capital flight when they go to war. And they've done that all the time. I mean, even World War II, you couldn't buy gold. So the Europeans were forced into buying mining stocks.
Marty, you know, in that respect, we've seen Bessent come out recently talking about currency swaps for the Gulf and for some Asian countries as well. Is this more about direct access to dollars and liquidity rather than, let's say, the importance of trade balances?
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the reason gold went down for a couple months into April, as our computer had forecast, was two aspects. One, Russia was selling some gold because of the sanctions. But two, when the Gulf War started, Iran sent more missiles to attack UAE than they did Israel. Why? Because UAE became more or less the new Switzerland. When Switzerland confiscated Russian assets, just simply claiming, oh, well, you knew Putin. They lost all their everything that Switzerland was known for. So the capital started fleeing and went to Dubai and it went to Singapore. Now, as you know, we had, you know, offices there in UAE. We had staff there, and I can tell you that there's also a big AI center there. Amazon, OpenAI, etc. It's over a $30 billion project that they had built. And Iran attacked that. They didn't destroy it, but they definitely caused some damage to the point that the banking system in UAE went down for 7 days. Most people don't know that because they didn't really want to report it so much. I couldn't even get money to my staff. I was trying to get my staff the hell out of there. People were selling gold. Banks were shut. So basically if you had gold in hand, that's how transactions were taking place. So that's why you saw the gold decline into April, and everybody's like, there's a war, it should be going up. When there's no banking system, that's basically what happened. I'm not real optimistic going forward. I think that things are going to heat up again. And I did a report, which you can get from the site. It's on the real sovereign debt crisis. And this is another area which I think is going to shock a lot of people. The sovereign debt crisis may start in the Middle East. During COVID, oil fell to about $6.50. So the Gulf states started borrowing aggressively, and they accumulated big debts. Of course, they haven't paid them off like anybody else. And so what's happened is Iraq is probably the worst. China stepped in, lent them a lot of money, but the contracts are if they default, they get their oil assets. All right. Now, Iran is very smart. They're far smarter than anybody in the West. So they were attacking the Gulf state production. All right. On the one hand, it sent oil prices up, and you're putting pressure on the West. But it also, by cutting off their production, the Gulf states were in trouble, because if you can't sell the oil, you can't pay the debt.
Right.
So you're in a situation where we can see a sovereign debt crisis, and most people have no idea that you get a sovereign debt crisis that starts in the Middle East. They think the image is that they've got all this money in their flush, and it's just not true. So the problem would be, you get a sovereign debt crisis where they can't pay their debt. That sets in motion a banking crisis. And coming from the Middle East, the traders are going to go, oh, shit, who's next? Then they're going to look at Europe, etc. That's when Greece got in trouble in 2010. The traders immediately said, oh, we made a lot of money on that one. Who's next? Oh, Spain. That's how a trading room works. Mm-hmm. All right. And so we're looking at that as a real, probably a shock that would send capital fleeing. You're already seeing UAE asking for swap lines, showing there is stress already. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it is a liquidity crisis caused by this Iranian war. Trump can keep his, embargo on and blocking the strait. This is not helping. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't think he's gotten proper information that the longer you keep the strait closed, the more they can't pay their debts. And they're asking for swap lines because you're going to force the Gulf states into a sovereign debt crisis. So this can get a lot worse than people realize. So it's not just an oil crisis. You got shutting down the strait. You also have, you know, fertilizer coming from there. But then there's a third element that people don't, hasn't really made the headlines that I know of, is sulfuric acid. Mm-hmm. The bulk of that comes from there. You need that to mine copper and nickel. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the ramifications of this is far, really far reaching that Iran understands. I question whether anybody in the West does. And then on top of all of that, that AI center, why is it there in UAE? The cables that connect the East and West all run through the bottom of the Strait of Hormuz. I had a conversation. I warned them, if I were Iran, I would have sent divers down and put charges alongside it. If you're going to take me out, I'm pushing that button and taking the rest of you with me. You bring down the whole banking system.
I saw there was a report about how Dubai would be completely cut off if they severed their internet connection, basically. And it's something that, for example, Starlink can't handle the bandwidth to make up for, right?
Right. It's everything is so interconnected. Mm-hmm. And that AI center in UAE, you have Amazon, OpenAI, they're all there.
Mm-hmm. Marty, what, you know, we're seeing reports today that the UAE is going to leave OPEC and OPEC Plus. What do you think the, let's say, the goal of that is?
Largely, they don't want to be constrained anymore. And it's a real problem in the sense that politically, the group was more or less lining up with the West against Iran. And they were the number one target because they, like I said, they became the Switzerland of the Middle East. So targeting Dubai, I mean, everybody was there. I mean, we had offices there. I mean, you know, your next door neighbors are, et cetera, you know, because they have a free trade zone. So all the foreigners, we all had to be in the same area. So it's an interesting situation, but attacking UAE was a very important economic strategy, which showed me that Iran was far smarter than anybody on the West side planning what the hell to do. You know, Iran has one of the highest educated societies in engineering, in science. I think they have a 99% reading rate, which is higher than a lot of places, even in Europe. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I mean, the Shah was quite beneficial in a way, but it came back and bit him in the ass. He was sending people to, you know, United States and UK in the 70s, fully paid educations, etc. Problem was, they became indoctrinated with the leftist agendas in the universities and then went back and started the revolution. So if you really look at the Iranian Revolution of 79, it was a merger of Marxism with Islam. So it became very, that's why, you know, the United States was a great Satan, et cetera. It was Marxist. Mm-hmm. That was the Marxist side of it. And so we have to understand, you know, what, you know, that's why I say the Shah, on the one hand, wanting to help his people, ended up, it bit them in the ass because of what they were teaching in the universities back then. Mm-hmm.
So, Martin, you know, we see nations meeting publicly, trying to, let's say, map out a future without oil and gas while scrambling to secure more supply in the interim here. How dramatic do you think this energy crisis is going to get?
It's not going to be as crazy as it was in the 70s. Because a lot of alternatives have come up. But in the 70s, the stagflation that really took place was because people didn't realize that even plastics came from oil. So it was more of a cost push inflation that you were suddenly, the cost of production rose in just about everything. Whereas that's not necessarily taking place this time. We have alternatives. Think people understand a little bit better. Also, the fact that what I find interesting is how our computer forecast that the U.S. would go into a recession, but Europe would go into a depression into 28. And I was saying this, you know, since 24, and now you can see it. U.S. is a minimal net importer. We only get at best 3% from the Middle East.
Minimum net importer of oil.
Yeah.
Okay.
Whereas Europe is completely screwed. Same thing in Asia. We have offices in Thailand, and I can tell you, our staff there couldn't even get gasoline for a scooter. That's one aspect. But the other side, more serious, was the lack of diesel. Without the diesel fuel, the ships couldn't go out and fish. So it was impacting the food supply. That's why I say this is far more complicated than people realize. So the ramifications we saw in the 70s, for example, back then I had lived in Marlton and my office was in Princeton, and you were getting gasoline, restrictions. You could only buy $2 every other day based upon your license plate, odd and even. I had to go buy a Ford Pinto station wagon, four cylinder, because I couldn't get to work on $2 two days in a row. So I mean, that was the 70s. And, you know, the lines at a gas station, it was odds and evens. And so We don't see that here today. And I don't think you're going to experience that sort of a shortage in the United States. Mm-hmm. Prices will go up because prices are dictated by the global supply. But we're not looking at the same kind of catastrophe we had in the 70s. And there in Canada, the whole climate change nonsense of Trudeau, comes to the surface today. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have Alberta, which is like the Texas of Canada on the commodity side, but you have no gas, no pipelines to the east. So the east is actually having to import oil because they can't get it from Alberta. Mm-hmm. So this is also going to fuel the continued rising separatist movements there. And as I explained in the conferences there I did in Calgary and in Vancouver, this is a global problem. All right. It's not just separation for Canada. We're getting separatist movements rising everywhere, mainly because when you get a centralized, federalized government, it ends up being one size fits all. They overrule the needs of local, just like you saw with Ursula, rigging the elections in Hungary. We don't like you because you're doing something that the rest of us want to do and you say no. And so it becomes a dictatorship. So you will see Europe break apart. I remember back in the 80s in Canada when there was big real estate speculation in Toronto and the central bank was raising interest rates all the time to fight that. Meanwhile, they're putting farmers and miners into bankruptcy in the West. We called it in the United States the Texas-New York arbitrage. When Texas was doing really well because oil prices were up, that's inflationary and New York's crying. Mm-hmm. When oil's down, they're in depression in Texas and New York's cheering, we're making a lot of money. So Canada's the same sort of problem. And those tensions will impact things and eventually you're going to see Canada will split.
Mm-hmm. Marty, as you know, we've been talking about the ramifications of energy prices, which, you know, also dovetails into the cost of fertilizer. We're seeing farm bankruptcies spike. And this also, the unavailability of fertilizer is also kind of coming right at a pivotal time in the spring here for planting season. So not only do we have energy price shocks, we have, possible food shortages / climbing food prices. Are we going to see inflation like we saw in the 70s? Or is this a very different case because of the stagflationary environment of the 70s that you mentioned earlier?
Well, it is a cost push type inflation rather than demand. There are three types of inflation, which they really don't talk about in school, but one of the more common ones is currency inflation. So if your currency were to devalue by 50%, then everything else has an international value and it will rise. Okay. So you can get inflation from the currency movement. then you have demand, you know, speculative demand, which is what they typically paint inflation as. And that's not true, but like, you know, the roaring 20s, et cetera. All right. But then the third type is cost push inflation, where it's not the demand that's rising. It's the cost of actually producing it is rising. So that gets filtered off into higher prices as well. And the difference is that this is why you get a lot of these people saying, oh, the stock market's going to crash 80%. They're looking at it from a demand side and, rather than in a capital preservation side, on that and cost push rather than speculative demand. So I do see food prices going up. Wheat is one of the, a leading indicator on that sort of thing. Most people don't realize, but food shortages have caused separations and revolutions. The French Revolution was technically over bread. You know, the saying, you know, let them eat cake was what was left in the pan after you cooked the bread. And it was the cake that not, you know, sweet cake, but it was the stuff that clung to the pan afterwards, the scraps. So it was really bread shortage of food that inspired the French Revolution.
What's the saying, Marty? Isn't it every country is only three meals away from a revolution?
Pretty much. It's you know, you're going to see that in New York City. New York City has they say basically only about a 7-day food supply. And then you have all these people, you know, like, no matter how many times, you know, the leftists have come up with these ideas like Mandami, they've never worked once. They don't look at history. You now have the extreme left occupying the governor's mansion in New York, demanding that they basically just take the wealth of the rich and give it to them. You know, it's just him with his, you know, with COVID, you know, they shut down. I mean, we had clients that were in farmers. One had to kill 30,000 chickens. He couldn't get trucks to bring him food. And at the same time, he couldn't get trucks to take him to market.
Right.
So then he had to kill 30,000 chickens. And then the politician says, oh, it's the greed of the farmers that egg prices went up.
Right.
I mean, it's like, sounds good. Beats the drums for the leftists. Oh yeah, go get those rich farmers, right? You're the one that prevented them from even bringing anything to market.
Yeah.
That's why I say, like we were talking about before, it's just, it's pure stupidity. Mm-hmm. They have no clue how the economy works or anything. And, you know, this whole thing, you can look up President Grover Cleveland in the panic of 1893. He's the only one that explained it properly, I think. He said the unsound finance of the left back then, all right, the rich can take their money and put it offshore. They refuse to invest. They refuse to basically participate. So what happens? You go into a recession. People hoard their money. All right. So then it's the worker who cannot take his labor and stick it offshore. So it's always the average person that ends up paying for this stuff. And so no matter how many times you yell at them, you do this, it's only going to come back and hurt the working person. They want to hear it. Mm-hmm. Oh, but he's got more money than me. That's not fair. You know, look, I find it curious that their whole proposition is forbidden in the Ten Commandments, showing that this is a human nature problem that has existed for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, goods, or whatever. You know, but that's Marxism. He's got more than me, and that's not fair. It's one of the Ten Commandments. So it's obviously we have a problem. And no matter how many times the left tries it and you try to say, listen, this is going to end in a disaster, they don't want to hear it. It just feels better to steal somebody else's money.
Right.
That's what it's always about.
So, Marty, what do you think the path forward is here in this point in time? You know, midterms are coming up in November. What is the path forward for Trump? Who do the Democrats even have that provides, let's say, an attractive choice for voters? Or is this another case that you and I have spoken about before, that this is just another typical pendulum swing from right to left and left to right?
Unfortunately, look, I met Netanyahu, most people don't realize, but he went to school in Philadelphia, both grade school and high school. All right. He hung out with the Crystals. I knew Bill Crystal, even spoke at one of our conferences. But it was his father, Irving, who started the whole neocon movement. So I knew Netanyahu was a neocon. And no different than John Bolton. I think John Bolton would invade Canada to get three Russians, you know. That's the mentality of these people. Mm-hmm. So when they use Netanyahu to flip Trump, I could see it coming. I mean, this is the real problem. And so I don't think Trump realized what he stepped into. I mean, he ran on ending these neocon wars and ends up doing them. I think he thought he's dealing with a head of state rather than a neocon. But I don't think he understood Netanyahu's background. Mm-hmm. And so Netanyahu is, my personal opinion, he should be locked up in a padded cell along with Zelensky and let the two of them fight it out there. I mean, both of them are completely unchained. And, I mean, here you have Trump lifting sanctions on Russia to help the world. And Zelensky says, no, I don't give a shit, and attacked Russians, you know, energy infrastructure to reduce their production by 40%. Mm-hmm. It's my way or nobody. I don't care what happens to Germany or anybody else. So you have these two egotistical nut jobs between Zelensky and Netanyahu. And Netanyahu appears also to be involved in this prophecy stuff. And one of the prophecies, I think, for their Messiah to come or whatever, and he'll come to save Israel because the entire world will turn against Israel. And you see that. American polls are showing they've turned against Israel. 40 Democrats voted against sending any money to Israel. Netanyahu, I put on my blog, he spoke at the UN. He testified before Congress. You know, Saddam Hussein's got weapons of mass destruction. We have to go in and eliminate him. That's where all this shit has come from. And it's always the same story. Netanyahu, I think, is a very dangerous man. He has this idea that if he assassinates the heads, that the body will collapse. So the first thing he did, day one, take out the Ayatollah. It didn't work. Okay, Iran understood his strategy. Iran has a four-layer deep, and they restructured their entire political system after the 25 attack because they understood what Netanyahu does. All right, and that's why these peace talks were put in Pakistan, because he wouldn't attack Pakistan because they have nukes as well.
Right.
Look, he's just a very dangerous person. And he thinks that if the whole world turns against him, that the Messiah will come and Israel will rise. I mean, and then on the other side, Shia, they also think this is the end times. So, you know, my question falls on the side of, all right, even if we assume that these prophecies are correct, are they valid if you deliberately try to make them happen?
Well, that was exactly what I wanted to ask you is, you know, you have these two religions that have, you know, millions and billions of people that subscribe to each one, they understand and know this theory of the end times. Is it possible that they're, you know, this is a synthetic production, let's say, by, you know, the people in charge to bring about these end times? And exactly as you're saying, does it still work if it is the, you know, a synthetic production of it rather than the, let's say, natural order of the evolution of it?
I question that because there have been numerous people over the years that have attempted to bring this about and have failed. Mm-hmm. I mean, even Napoleon thought he was going to resurrect the Roman Empire. You know, I question whether, you know, you can synthetically manufacture this. I don't know. I'm not sure anybody really knows. But there's one passage in there in Samuel that says, you know, the Amalekites said for Israel to kill all of them, the women, the children, and, you know, the camels and the donkeys. And when Iran missile hit a building, Netanyahu was out there, we will remember them. And he refers to them as that passage. So clearly he's always been after Iran. That's been the number one goal. even General Wesley Clark, after he went to the Pentagon after 9/11, was told they were going into Iraq. They did not have... He asked them, you connected Saddam to 9/11? They said no. And they showed him, which he has spoken about, it's on YouTube, in his 2007 speech, that he was shown documents then that they intended to invade the Middle East and conquer 7 countries. So, I mean, you know, these are the problems we have. And I think what I've observed over the years is these people are deliberately attempting to infiltrate government to fulfill their objectives. If you look at the Biden administration, you had Blinken, who was removed Russia from SWIFT. You had Victoria Nuland, and you had the Attorney General Garland. All three claim to have come from the Balkan Ukraine area. All three claim that Russia persecuted their families. Mm-hmm. How can three people with the same background end up in the same administration? Mm-hmm. They, to me, they had to weasel their way in to try and create this war with Russia. It's a personal vendetta. I mean, it's not national security. That's why people are fed up with these endless wars. It's these people that infiltrate government for personal reasons. You had, you know, the same thing with Madeleine Albright. She was from Czechoslovakia, and she's the one that got the United Nations to attack Serbia. Why? Because Serbia was pro-Russia. Russia persecuted her family. Same shit. I'm sick and tired of it. I think anybody that has a personal conflict of interest should be barred from government.
That's a big ask, Marty.
Look, all they do is create nothing but death and destruction. And they could care less. I think that's what our computer is showing when it's saying about 2032. More and more people today are understanding that the system doesn't work. Mm-hmm. You and I know it, but I'm talking about the average person on the street is starting to realize it. And that's what it's going to take. What the computer shows in for 2032 is, I think, a light at the end of the tunnel. That we go through these major political revolutions roughly every 300 years or so. Last time we overthrew monarchy and created these fake democracies that are really republics. Hopefully this time republics are the most corrupt form of government. We get rid of that and we go maybe to a direct democracy where we actually vote on stuff. Shall we go to war with Iran? Yes or no? We make the decision, not three guys smoking cigars in the back room mm-hmm. that are never elected.
So, Marty, just to circle back on that last question, what do you expect out of the midterms here? Like, is Trump support... I read a stat this morning that it's the lowest of any modern president right now. Is that just that typical pendulum swing, you think?
I think so. You know, it's going to be hard. I think Trump can try and spin it any which way he wants, but most of the time, statistically, on the midterm, it will turn against whoever's in power. The computer, when I ran it over a year ago, it was showing a very tight race to begin with at 50-50. So I'm not real optimistic that and I did a report on the fate of Israel, and the computer was showing that we may reach the point here where the United States disavows Israel. And so if the midterms do flip to the Democrats, you already had 40 of them refuse to send any arms to Israel. Mm-hmm. So Netanyahu is very unpopular. He's taking all of the image of Israel with him. Mm-hmm. So you have rising anti-Semitism. I mean, that's to be expected. They're just going to blame all Jews for his actions. And I think he's prepared for that, because as I said, their end prophecy is that the world will turn against Israel, and that's when their Messiah is supposed to come. Mm-hmm. So I think he's completely prepared for that. Maybe has deliberately trying to create that. It's hard to imagine. I mean, these people are psychopaths, in my opinion. But normally, if we look at it just even from a statistical basis, the midterms usually do turn against whoever's in power at the time. Mm-hmm. And the computer is showing that we're looking at a very steep recession into 28 and in the United States, and a depression outside. So I'm not so sure that the Democrats would bring an end to the Iran war, but they're certainly going to distance themselves from Israel.
Well, Marty, it's certainly interesting times, and I always appreciate you, you know, giving us your insight and your experience to how these things are playing out. Is there anything you'd like to leave our listeners with to think about before we wrap up here?
No, I think, you know, we just see tensions rising everywhere, from Asia to Russia to Middle East. It's I don't know, maybe somebody put something in the water or whatever, but they're all going crazy at this point. Mm-hmm.
Well, for those that want to read that sovereign debt crisis piece, that's available at armstrongeconomics.com and, of course, on X at Armstrong Econ. Marty, thanks so much for your time today. Always a pleasure, sir.
Well, it's always a pleasure to see you. Take care of yourself up there.
Thank you very much. We'll